Committee on Civil Laws in session. I will give you a couple of ideas what we're going to do today. We will not hear Senate Bill 333, and I think the revision takes that one off. We're going to proceed into a work session first on House Bill 2157A to accommodate our representatives that are here. We do not have a quorum to act in a work session. We'll have to wait until we get a quorum later this morning, so it's likely we'll be leaving some work sessions open until to accommodate that. Council, what do you have some remarks, and then we'll set up the panel on 2157A.
Mr. Chair, Ackerman, members of the committee, 2157A is back before this committee. Between the time it was heard and this time, we met with interested parties in a work group and kind of worked out some of the issues that the committee raised. There are some more amendments. They go through the dash A3s through the dash A17s, and the representatives will point out which amendments that the work group has kind of consolidated that should be adopted by the committee, and we'll further discuss some of the issues that this committee raised. Specifically, I want to point out either the dash A15s or really the A18s. I want to point out both of those amendments. Those insert some limiting language, and that was one of the, I think, the major issues that this committee raised. But those insert limiting language in the statute, which limits what agencies, who they can require record checks from.
Okay, I'll call up our representatives. They're here this morning. Representatives, see who's here.
Cameron and Galizio.
Cameron and Galizio and Andrea Meyer will come up, please. And I need an agency representative. I don't know who wants that role, but we need your voice here. This is invited testimony at the work session. It's not a public hearing. If I haven't done so, I'm opening the work session on House Bill 2157A. Before we begin, I kind of want to get a little broader view of where we may be coming from, and then let me know what amendments would specifically apply to the proceeding here this morning. I had a concern last time that the language in Section 2, citing 174.111, basically brought all three branches of our state government within the Act. And then I noted that we had a number of amendments coming in where specific agencies wanted to come in. So I thought that was a conflict. Is that resolved in any of these, Council?
Yes, that issue is taken care of, Representative Ackerman. Specifically, I'll point you to, if you look at the Engross bill, page 1, line 14, that describes subject individual. This is really the limiting language that makes this an opt-in provision. As you see above that, there's a definition of authorized agency, and that is very broad. And then below that, line 17, it goes through what an authorized agency can do, and it specifically states that they can get record checks for subject individual. The definition of subject individual goes on to say that only an agency can only get a fingerprint background check for a subject individual through enabling legislation, enabling authority. That issue, if it needed to be further addressed, was in the I guess the dash 18 amendments in the dash 15 amendments. I think it was already clear in the original bill that this is an opt-in provision. LC further clarified that for us, and that was the intention all along from the work group. LC was aware of that, and that's how this the Engross version was drafted, and I think the amendments go on to further clarify that issue. So again, the point is that the language defining a subject individual goes on to clarify that it is, it makes this an opt-in statute. So there's not a structural problem in that regard.
Is there any formality to opt-in?
There would be. An agency would need enabling legislation, and that's why you have before you almost 20 amendments.
Okay.
Some of the agencies are included in the Angress version, and then subsequently agencies came forward to be included, and that accounts for several of these amendments.
Okay. Thank you for that overview. I want to make sure that I got some of my issues addressed without going through a lot of testimony. How do you wish to proceed, panel? I'd like to maybe an overview as to whether there is an agreement and what amendments are applicable.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. For the record, Kevin Cameron, representative from District 19. Thank you for having us here this morning. I'll just start out with that since we were before you the last time, we got together with another work group to address the concerns. I have a list of the amendments if you'd like me to proceed through those amendments and just real quickly tell you what each one of those amendments do. There was reference to two amendments that are real critical to the bill, to agreement. We were just handed amendment A18, which was language that was actually authored by Andrea Meyer and the ACLU to tighten down even A15 even more that we would like to talk about in more detail. But why don't I start with just real quick the amendments that we would recommend that the committee adopt this morning.
Are these agreement, all agreed now, or is there some contest on these? You should...
I believe that
it's fine for you to go through. I just want to make sure you can state that the Dash 18s are agreeable and you can explain it, or if there's going to be some contest, I need to know that right away.
Okay, the Dash 18s, specific about the Dash 18s, the only contest there is that they will need to be followed up, and DHS has agreed to this because there's on the Dash 18, there's language that specifically talks about elderly individuals being 65 years old. On Dash 18's line 17, instead of in the Dash 15's where it said vulnerable persons, the language now would read deals with children, persons who are at least 65 years of age, or persons with disabilities. That needs to be changed, as it is in current law at DHS, a statute to 60 years old, and we can do that on the Senate side with a simple amendment.
So let me just hold right there.
Right.
So the only change you need on Dash 18 is to change the age from 65 to 60?
Correct.
Okay, now...
Chair Ackerman.
Ms. Meyer, is that correct?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. If I can take a moment and put the context of what these amendments do, because as we'll talk about some substantive changes to the measure. As I testified, and I've given you a copy of my testimony from last time, one of the ACLU's major concerns was all these agencies had been added on, but that their scope of who they could authorize to be fingerprinted in statute was extremely broad. I mean, the employee language, the contractor, vendor. I'm looking at you to see if this triggers your recollection about our concerns that were set forth in all those subsequent sections. A lot of the Dash amendments you had before you also added new agencies. Our concerns was pretty much uniform, that needed to be narrowed. There are two ways to narrow it. Have each agency come in and articulate specifically their scope. The example I'd given was the military department had already had pre-existing language that limited the scope of who could get the fingerprints. You're dealing with, in this bill, agencies that have already have the authority to do FBI nationwide fingerprints, some who have the authority to do statewide, and some who've never had the authority. So that's why it's such a mixed bag. So one way of fixing it was to have each agency articulate, and we had been asking for that, but that didn't happen. We're near the end of the session. The other approach, which is what appears in the 15s and the 18s, is that in Section 2, the general language about what all agencies must do, the safeguards, the fitness determination, et cetera, that all agencies must comply with, would limit the scope there. And so if you look at the A18s, Starting on lines 11 of it, you first authorize it for all licensing, certification, registration, and permit requirements, and then all the agencies that are and departments and everyone who is swept up in this bill could go ahead and do it for those who have access, employees or anyone, contractors, vendors, who have access to or deals with confidential information. Confidential information is defined on line 3 and 4. Again, that's one difference between the A18s and the A15s. We felt it important to define that. Lines 15 has access to property to which access is restricted in order to protect the public's health and safety. Pretty broad language, but has some limiting. Instead of vulnerable persons, because no one knew what that definition was, it again was so broad. The attempt in line 17 and 18 is to be more clear and consistent with the past. Children's persons who are at least and were fine with 60 years of age, or persons with disabilities. Lines 19 and 20 deal with people who also have control of systems that store, process, and transport confidential information, which might be slightly different than those who on line 14 have access to it. There might be those who use the computer systems who shouldn't have access to it, but who deal with the technical components of the machinery and may unintentionally have access. 21 and 22 is the fiduciary financial and fiscal responsibilities, requiring the person to be the person's primary responsibility. And finally, the issues of exposure to chemical and hazardous material facilities, and the last one being firearms and munitions. This, in light of where we are in the session, is an approach I guess the ACLU can live with. You know, we're still quite concerned about the scope of who is swept into this bill. We'd still like to see examples of, like, the Legislative Administrative Committee Section 57 removed. And then one last thing, Chair. Our concerns about the Lottery Commission have not been addressed. Now, the Lottery Commission has been doing this for years, as have some other agencies. It's not their authority that we have concerns about. It's that they be required to do that fitness determination, that they ensure some of the safe protections that we insist on, that we look at someone's record and determine in terms of everything whether they should or should not be employed. I'll answer more questions, but I just hope that gives an overview of where we are with our concerns, and I appreciate the indulgence of the committee.
Let me just hang on a minute, because we're having scheduling difficulties as well as quorum difficulties today. Let me look at my sheet. What I want to do is accommodate Senator Walker on another matter, which will just take a couple of minutes. So if we could just withdraw from the panel for a moment, I will keep this public hearing open and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 273A. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I'm so glad you could accommodate my schedule, which is just horrendous. I'm here on Senate Bill 273. It comes to you from the Senate, and it actually increases the exemption amounts, and I bet your committee counsel wants to talk about that before I do.
Chair Ackerman, I'm happy to summarize it.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 273A is sponsored by the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, and this would increase the exemption set out in ORS 18.345. That is the list of property that the legislature has deemed exempt from enforcement of a creditor's civil judgment. The current amount for a homestead exemption for a single debtor is $25,000. For a joint debtor is $33,000. Those would be increased respectively to $30,000 in the case of a single debtor and $39,600 in the case of a joint debtor. There's a separate exemption for a vehicle that is currently $1,700, and that would be increased to $2,150. There are three amendments before you, but I'm not going to spend too much time summarizing them unless you're going to be considering them more than I think you are.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll let Senator Walker sum this up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Leary, you are dead right on there. We are not going to be considering those amendments this morning, Mr. Chair, unless you have an idea to do so. We actually would like you to consider the bill as is, as it came over from the Senate. I think that's music to the ears of Mr. David Niebel, who represents the consumer law section. Well, he represents the Oregon State Bar, and he works for the consumer law section. This bill was brought forward, Mr. Chair, because we review these exemptions. It appears every 12 years, and I found that out because I did my research. Surprise. But I went into the archives, used the services of Dave Harrell and Library, and found out that we established these exemptions in 1981, we changed them in 1993, and then now again it's 12 years down the pike and it's time to elevate these exemptions again. They're increased only a mere 20% for simply the homestead and the auto. It's a very conservative increase, one that I think is justified. I won't take any more time because there are people here who will talk about it later, but what's interesting to note, Mr. Chair, is that both Mr. Niebel and Mr. Marquis testified on these changes in 1993 when they were made. So we still have two of the same people in the building, which I think is kind of fun. But I think this is fair, particularly given that Congress has changed the bankruptcy laws at the federal level, which impacts the states, makes bankruptcy even more difficult for regular folks to obtain a bankruptcy. This gives them the fresh start that we expect. As I said, it's only a 20% increase in those two exemptions only. We're not impacting any other exemption, and there are many available. So, Mr. Chair, I would ask respectfully that you pass this bill. I think it's really good for Oregonians. No one wants anyone to be able to get out of from under their debt, but there are a lot of reasons why people have to file bankruptcy, and that's what it's for.
Thank you, Senator. Questions, Representative Girard?
Not so much a question other than a statement, Senator. I thank you for doing this. It's not enough. In my opinion, we should be looking at doubling or tripling these amounts, but I want to thank you for at least bringing this to our attention.
Mr. Chair and Representative Girard, you're welcome. And we did, I will say, that I was able to pass an exemption for the earned income credit two sessions ago. So we did add one more exemption, and that exemption was very important for poor families. And so we're making some progress, and I agree with you. I think it should have been higher, but this was a negotiated part of the work group, but the work group never came to agreement, and I pretty much had to run this through without agreement from all of the work group members. And one of the work group members and I sort of thought we were making modifications and changed the bill over here to meet some of the concerns, but not everyone agreed with that, so we decided to stick with what we've got. We think it's a good product, Mr. Chair, and committee members, and I hope that you agree.
Thank you, Senator. Representative McPherson has a question.
Senator Walker, are the numbers that are in the bill now, the engrossed version, which are in some instances kind of uneven numbers, are they just purely the result of compromise, or is there some coherent reason why 39,600 and 21,250 were arrived at?
20% increase, Mr. Chair, and Representative McPherson. And we did an analysis of all the western states, and Oregon is 10th. And you know, it's near the bottom. We took out the high western states and the low western states and came in the middle and bumped Oregon up to be a little more competitive with its surrounding states. And there are some states who the exemptions would make you choke, that someone could get that big of an exemption. And there are others who you would wonder why they would want people to live like that with nothing after a complete bankruptcy. So this was a negotiated sort of deal, like it always is every 12 years, and 20% sounded good. Credit unions agreed with it right off the bat, but some of the other financial lenders did not like that. So California, the homestead exemption is $50,000 for an individual and $75,000 for a family. And then you go to Arizona, and the homestead exemption is $150,000. So, you know, Oregon, we're doing all right. I think this is okay. I'm okay with it.
Make sure we're on 973.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
Okay, further questions of the Senator? Seeing none, thank you, Senator.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I think what we'll do is we have one other witness, but we have no opposition this morning, and my intention would be to roll this right into a work session. So,
okay, great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As long as only one other witness signed up on Senate Bill 273, I'll have that witness come forward, Justin Baxter.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, morning. Members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Justin Baxter. I'm the chair of the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section. I'll be brief this morning and I suppose echo the testimony of Senator Walker. In short, this legislation is important because it protects the most financially vulnerable consumers in Oregon. And it does it in a way to protect two important fundamental needs of those financially vulnerable consumers: the roof over their heads and a car to drive to work so that they can pay their bills. As Senator Walker indicated, there are a number of amendments before the committee, but the A. engrossed version of the bill, which passed the Senate, is a version which was negotiated by the interested parties and which the proponents of the bill can support today, and which I understand as of last night the United Finance Lobby will not oppose. And with those comments, I would be happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Thank you for your participation this morning. Are there questions from the committee to the witness? Thank you very much. You're excused. Any further witnesses on this bill? Seeing none, I'll close the work session on
public hearing.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 273A and open a work session on that bill. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I would move Senate Bill 273A to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves Senate Bill 273A to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Are there any comments, any discussion from committee members? Seeing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative
Worth
Asnett, Chair
Ackerman? Aye. Senate Bill 273A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is closed.
I'd be happy to carry that bill.
Yeah, Representative Girard will be the carrier.
Thanks, Mr.
Fyre. I see Senator Brown. Are you here?
Bills.
On two bills, okay.
But I finished my committee, so I'm available at your land.
Well, why don't we take it now, because we could be hung up a little bit later than you might want to stay. And if you could let me know what bills those are, then I will open a public hearing. I don't know what bills you're here on, so I
okay.
Don't know that question.
It's
great,
I do,
it's great
though,
to see you, and I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask you. But
973 and 965.
Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 973A.
All right.
Okay, let me have counsel explain the bill.
Sure, okay. That's fine.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 973A requires a petitioner of a minor child to file a statement containing full names and permanent addresses of the child, the petitioner, and persons with whom the child has lived with during the last 5 years, and the places where the child has lived during that period, and then if the names and addresses may be readily ascertained by the petitioner. And it also requires a petitioner to file, if known to the petitioner, any person who has physical custody of the child or claims rights of legal custody or physical custody of, or parenting time or visitation with a child. Again, this is the context of an adoption, someone who's petitioning for adoption. It also requires this petitioner to serve the petition to the child's grandparents if the parents are deceased or incapacitated, if the names and addresses are known or readily ascertainable by the petitioner.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represents Senate District 21. I very much appreciate your hearing this particular bill this morning. This bill, like many of the bills that we deal with, comes to you because of a tragedy. About 3 years ago, Ron and Joanne Johnson lost their daughter. Her name was Carrie Rapp. Carrie was murdered. At the time, Carrie had two children, both of whom had extensive contact with the Johnsons, their grandchildren. As a result of a subsequent adoption proceeding by a member of the father's family, the Johnsons have lost not only their legal relationship with their grandson, but frankly the emotional one they had with him as well. The unfortunate aspect of this case is that the Johnsons were not notified because Oregon law did not require it at the time to have a grandparent be notified of their grandchild's adoption. The tragedy was compounded by the fact that the Johnsons have guardianship of the other grandchild. So you have losses at a number of levels. The grandchild has lost a really important relationship with his half-brother, and the Johnsons are losing a relationship with their grandson. This bill simply provides grandparents with the same rights in adoption proceedings that we already give to grandparents in step adoption cases. I think it's a really good fix for Oregon law. It limits the notice to when the parent has died or has been incapacitated and when the addresses are readily ascertainable. So I urge your support. I'm happy to answer any questions. We worked really hard with the family law community, some of the judges, and DHS to create a fix that not only does not cost a lot of money, but I think would prevent this from happening to another family in the future. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
Fine. We'll do that in just 1 second, Senator. Senator Johnson, do you have an interest in this bill?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm here on the second bill that Senator Brown is here with.
Okay. We'll return to you then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions of the senator from the committee? Yes,
Chair,
Representative McPherson.
Senator Brown, what's the effect of the notice? That is, what would the grandparents, would they have an opportunity to intervene and right, maybe seek custody or visitation rights or something? What would be the effect of this?
The bill simply provides for notice so that they can be aware of the adoption proceedings and the court can take it from there. That's the same that happens in step-parent adoptions as well. I actually think it sort of begs the question about grandparents' rights in these cases. We just felt like we couldn't sort of resolve that entire issue. And that is allowing legal grandparents to maintain some type of legal relationship when there's a step-parent adoption or an adoption when their child has passed away. So that's an issue we'd like to tackle next session. We think the notice is critically important. In fact, the Johnson's case is quite complicated because they were involved, I believe, in a guardianship custody case, and at the same time, a family member filed this adoption proceeding and they were not notified of the adoption proceeding. I don't think that is likely to happen in Multnomah County because we tend to have a one family, one family in our family juvenile law courts, but it did happen in this case where they did not even receive notice, and we just want to get to that first step.
This is a great bill in my view, and I think I would encourage you to pursue the next step.
Fine. Thank you, Representative. Further questions of Senator Brown? Seeing none, thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
I have just one other witness on this that is in favor of the bill, and what I'd rather do is just call that witness up now, then roll us into a work session immediately. So our next witness, come forward, please.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Adoption Program Manager at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 973A. The written testimony is being given to you. In the interest of time, I won't read that testimony. I just want to give you the highlights of that. DHS originally opposed Senate Bill 973 for both fiscal and policy reasons. Senator Brown was very amenable to putting together a work group so that we could work on those concerns. We met on April 21st. And believe that we have come up with, as Senator Brown has said, a very good solution that really speaks to the Johnson family's situation and satisfy DHS's fiscal and policy concerns. I do want to say that DHS was not directly involved in the Johnson situation. Had we been, it might have had a different outcome. But we are the petitioner in about a third of the adoptions in Oregon, so we have a keen interest in this bill. With the changes that were made through the work group, only in rare circumstances would the resulting statute affect DHS, and that would not have a fiscal impact for us. Moreover, when it does apply to a child who is in DHS custody for whom we're doing adoption planning, the notification to the parents of the deceased parent of a child for whom adoption is being planned conforms with our current practice. So therefore, we're very supportive of this bill. And so in summary, we do support the bill, and we believe that the resulting statute will be very beneficial for children in Oregon.
Fine. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee to the witness? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Any further witnesses wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 973A and open a work session on that bill. A motion from Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 273A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I thought we were on 973. Did you say 273?
Say 973.
Yes. Okay. Representative Girard moves that Senate Bill 273A proceed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee?
973.
Okay, we'll get it right. 973. Discussion on the Senate Bill 973A. Okay, hearing done. Please call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Flores?
Absent. Chair
Ackerman? Aye. Senate Bill 973A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And I'll close the work session on that bill. Thank you. Representative Gerard, do you want to carry that one?
As a grandparent with nine grandchildren, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. We can't beat that this morning. I think Senators Brown and Johnson are here on Senate Bill 965. Is that correct, Senators? Okay, I get head nods on that one. All right, great. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 965A. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Are you going to let, do you want committee counsel to tell you about the bill?
Counsel?
Members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 965A comes to you from the Rules Committee via Senators Johnson and Senator Brown. This would create the civil cause of action of invasion of personal privacy. The tort could be proven one of four ways. If a person makes a visual recording of the plaintiff in the state of nudity in times and circumstance where the plaintiff has reasonable expectation of privacy without the plaintiff's consent. If the if the defendant is in a location to observe the plaintiff in a state of nudity, again, reasonable expectation of privacy without content, consent. Three, if the defendant makes a recording or views an intimate area, as opposed to state of nudity, of the defendant in an area where the plaintiff has a reasonable expectation of privacy without consent. And four, if the defendant disseminates a visual recording of the plaintiff in a state of nudity in a time and place where the plaintiff has a reasonable expectation of privacy without consent. In any of those four ways, a prevailing plaintiff is entitled to compensatory damages, liquidated damages in a range from $1,000 to $5,000, and reasonable attorney fees. The measure provides a statute of limitations of 2 years from the conduct. It applies to conduct occurring on or after the effective date. There is an emergency clause. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Senator Johnson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr.
You're
Chair.
On the wrong side of the building.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16. My interest in this bill stemmed from a fact situation in Astoria wherein the father of a young woman was in a aquatic center with a special camera fitted, a camera fitted with a special lens, taking pictures of his daughter as well as her teenage colleagues as they were participating in a swim meet. And the filter attached to this camera ostensibly stripped away all vestiges of their bathing suits. It works particularly well in thin, tight material, as one would expect in bathing suits, and rendered these young women virtually naked. Obviously, this was a horrifying shock to these young women when they discovered not only had they been filmed, but that the film was being made available in public venues in Astoria. And so the parents of some of these aggrieved young women came to me, and that was the genesis of the bill. Senator Brown and I discovered through legislative counsel that we were both working on similar concepts. I had such, I believed, a persuasive fact scenario that Senator Brown allowed me to join her on her suite of bills. And I come before you to say that this is an attempt, this bill, to have technology, the law keep up with technology. I was really horrified in doing some additional research to discover that these lenses are available quite economically on the Internet, and they have the net effect of really stripping away vestiges of clothing and yield quite revealing photographs. And I think that these young women certainly deserve an expectation of not having technology peek through their clothing. And so it was with that motivation that I joined Senator Brown in what I think is important legislation, and would ask for your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to Senator Johnson. Just a couple of things. The original purpose of the bill was to address upskirting video voyeurism, and that is the concern that folks have the ability to take photos up women's skirts by using wonderful camera devices. Senator Johnson's fact situation, she just explained, and then we had another additional situation happen with a woman in Beaverton who whose partner boyfriend took video pictures of her during intimate activities, and after they broke up, he put those photos on the Internet, inviting, posing as her, and invited folks to come date her. There was no law prohibiting that type of harassment or that type of putting photos on the Internet. So I do have a videotape showing the interview if any of you wish to see it. It's pretty disgusting. So this is one measure. I know that the House has another bill creating a criminal action that I'm hoping that the Senate will pass as well. So happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions of the committee to the witnesses? I just have a couple. Now that we have a lot of legal talent here. On sub B of section 1, line 10 and 11, At the end of 11 is the words, are the words, without the consent of the plaintiff. I assume you mean that doesn't modify that the defendant was in a location without the consent of the defendant, but the defendant was observing the plaintiff in the state of nudity without her consent. Is that how you would read that? I just want to get the statutory construction thing on the record.
I would, Mr. Chair, but I haven't had the opportunity to use my legal mind in an appropriate setting for a number of years, so I'd certainly defer to legal counsel.
And, Mr. Chair, I could get you time on a divorce, so I also would defer to legal counsel.
Could you, Chair Ackerman, could you repeat the line and page number?
Okay, on the first page, at the end of line 11, it says, without the consent of, and I'm trying to figure out whether that modifies the being in the location to observe the plaintiff without the consent of the plaintiff, or whether that modifies the plaintiff's state of nudity.
Chair Ackerman, I believe they're referring to Section 1, sub B, that the subject line of without the consent of the plaintiff refers back to that the defendant was in a location to observe the plaintiff in a state of nudity.
I think that presents a question, because without the consent of the plaintiff, if the defendant was on a public sidewalk with this super camera gear, the plaintiff would not have any right to object to that person being there, and yet it's an element of the offense. How do you meet that contention?
Chair Ackerman, I would respond that the rest of that subparagraph and the remaining element of the tort contains the attendant circumstance that the plaintiff has to be in a place and circumstance where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of privacy. That is specifically defined by the bill in page 2, line 24. Places and circumstances where the plaintiff has a reasonable expectation of personal privacy includes, but is not limited to, bathroom, dressing room, locker room, enclosed area for dressing, showering, tanning booth, and any area where a person undresses in an enclosed space not open to public view. The scenario that you lay out, a person on a public sidewalk, I think would definitely not meet that element of the tort, and therefore it wouldn't be applicable.
Okay, I guess I'm still worried about the situation where the defendant is in a position, a location, and the plaintiff does not have the legal right to not to prohibit the person from being there. So her consent becomes unnecessary. I also think that it might give a defense to the defendant. The defendant can say, well, I was on a public sidewalk, and the plaintiff has no right to revoke my privilege to be there.
Chair Ackerman,
I'm like a defense lawyer, but I have to in this situation.
I just want to understand correctly. So the scenario you're painting is that the plaintiff is within the enclosed space, and the defendant.
No, I'm forgetting where the plaintiff is. It's the location of the defendant.
And the defendant is in a public place.
The witness read that they'd have to prove that the plaintiff would have to prove that the defendant was in a location without the consent of the plaintiff. And if that's a public park, for example, she could not revoke that privilege. She has no standing.
Mr. Chair, I actually think you're right, because there's two issues. Number one, state of nudity, and then number two, the fact situation that Senator Johnson described. First of all, the young women were not nude, number one, and number two, they don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy while they're in a swimming pool, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's mm-hmm. your point.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see that covers this.
Okay.
Senator Johnson's fact scenario.
Senator Johnson?
I too, Mr. Chair, agree that you are correct, and we have discussed this at some length prior to advancing the bill, whether or not a reasonable expectation of privacy exists in a public place such as an aquatic center. The reasonable expectation of privacy here is the expectation that someone is not using a device by which to peer through your clothing. And you've raised one of the trickier elements of this bill, and I would agree with your assertion that an aquatic center, when one is swimming in a public swimming pool, that reasonable expectation of privacy becomes more problematic.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and the other issue that you raise is on the fact scenario I described is that where you have a consenting plaintiff and defendant at the time the photographs were taken, what in that particular circumstance, I mean, I'm assuming she consented to those photographs, but what was not consented to was the release of those photographs onto the internet.
And I understand that the consent could apply to that. I'm still coming back to the consent to be at the location where the defendant is.
Yeah.
And if there's a construction problem, what I usually do here is we will conclude the public hearing at the appropriate time. If there's some rework we have to do to answer these contentions, we can do that by amendments and get them to you and put them into our work session before the full committee. So that's how we're operating here in the interest of time. I do have another question, counsel, and also a question to the witnesses. Why is it necessary in this case for the plaintiff to establish in, I will say, her claim that the purpose of the activity was to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of the defendant? Isn't just the act of this enough? And how do you prove that? And doesn't that make it a difficult case to win?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. What my staff person just whispered to me is that plaintiffs have a reasonable, this is from legislative counsel, and probably she would be the best person to bring up on this one is Virginia Bannerlout, but when a plaintiff has a reasonable, women, for example, have a reasonable expectation of privacy when they have a bathing suit on, they're not expecting that people be able to see through that bathing suit. So I don't know if that's helpful on your earlier question. I don't know the answer to this question.
And, Mr. Chair, I might add that when we were working on bringing forward the fact scenario in Astoria, we spent some time discussing the issue that you raise with the district attorney, Joshua Marquis. He ended up prosecuting or attempting to in the fact scenario that I had in Astoria. He may end up being a resource for committee staff, given his familiarity with my fact scenario.
See, I don't think that it's necessary to have that there, because the defendant would be just as culpable if he was going to be, he's already culpable because he's violated someone's privacy. His motives might not be any more relevant, and why have an element in here that you can't possibly be difficult to prove?
And Mr. Chair, I believe that Senator Brown and I would have no objection to the removal of that language if it advances the bill.
The bill's going to advance in any event. I'm trying to make it a better case for the plaintiff in court.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. My last question, and we'll discuss these with counsel and get back to you, is the claim for liquidated damages and also making a claim for compensatory damages. I understand the liquidated damages is to compensate the person for non-economic damages, but yet compensatory damages contains, I think, the same definitional term. Is there a duplication here, counsel?
Chair Ackerman, I'd have to look at the definition within the tort chapter, but my recollection is that I better not do it on the fly. I better look at the definition. There may be. Can I address one of the concerns, though, the first concern you raised? I think that the way the bill is crafted, there are four different paragraphs for each scenario. And the scenario that Chair Ackerman, that you were painting, I think, and that fits into the situation at the Aquatic Center that Senator Johnson was speaking of, fits better into what I think is subparagraph D, which is being in a place where you make a recording or view the intimate area of the plaintiff without the plaintiff's consent. And the way that intimate area is defined under the statute, it makes clear that that includes the situation that Senator Johnson testified to, where they're using this lens to see through clothing. I think that would be analogous to the defendant standing in the public park viewing the plaintiff. So then that's different from the visual recording of the plaintiff while the plaintiff is in a place with a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I think that it's structured right. Now, that's different than the other issue of whether or not to delete the arousing or gratifying sexual desire of defendant. That is a policy choice that you can certainly take out if you wish.
It makes it an easier case for the plaintiff if we take that out.
Mr. Chair, we're totally fine, and I think given that it's a civil action, that that's very appropriate.
All right.
And I would agree with legal counsel's reading, particularly of all the sort of the different fact scenarios we've described. I think the bill covers each one of them in its own way.
Right. Well, it's my intention to eliminate any defenses and make the bill clear and make it an easier case for the plaintiff. So,
thank you.
Chair Ackerman, could I suggest, for because we're late in the game and for purposes of time, you may wish to move for a conceptual amendment, and I can have that drafted in time for the full committee Friday.
Well, I think what I'd rather do, rather than go through what would be a conceptual amendment right now, would be to recommend to the committee that we move it to the full committee with the expectation that you and I will consult with the carriers of the bill and or the sponsors of the bill and forward a formal amendment to the full committee. I think it's just a cleaner way for me to do it.
Mr. Chair, one other question. I don't want to cause any more problems for this little bill, but I did receive a memo from Representative Bruin concerned that nudity may be defined too broadly in the bill. I just wanted to lay that issue out for you all.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there further questions or concerns? I didn't mean to make a little bill bigger, just a little bill better.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Further testimony on Senate Bill 965A. Hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 965A and open a work session. And the chair will move that Senate Bill 965A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, with the understanding that council and I will consult regarding potential amendments. Are there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Florence?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth absent? Chair Ackerman?
Aye. And since I raised all the problems, I'll carry the bill. And the work session is closed on Senate Bill 965 as it's afforded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Senator Monis Anderson, I see you sitting there. If I get to wait a little bit longer, I'll probably have a quorum of the Senate and we can really get something done. Are you here on a bill? 881. Okay, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 881. Senator? Or public hearing, I'm sorry.
Chair Ackerman, members of the subcommittee,
Council, go ahead.
Senate Bill 881 comes to you sponsored by Senator Monis Anderson. This bill would create a process for tracking of information about court-appointed trustees. Under the measure, before being appointed as a court-appointed trustee, a person would be required to submit a detailed statement to the court, including contact information, educational credentials, and any other trusts administered by the person, including the court numbers and the addresses of the courts. The person would be required to disclose additionally whether they had ever been removed by the court for cause as a trustee. If a person fails to comply with the disclosure requirement or provides false information, the measure gives the court the authority to remove the person as trustee and also to impose contempt as a sanction. If the trustee is removed, the court may provide or shall provide notice to the state court administrator, who in turn is obliged to keep records of that information for at least 5 years and make that information open to the public. This does not apply to trust companies, FDIC-insured companies, or other trusts specifically identified by rule by the Chief Justice. The measure also contains a sunset that automatically repeals the statute on January 2, 2010. There are no amendments before you.
Senator, would you like to start, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. I feel strongly about this bill, Senate Bill 881. I feel is a step toward preventing mismanagement of trusts by court-appointed trustees. And it was actually brought to me by a constituent of mine. Actually, it happened to a constituent of mine who was really unable to help himself. He's a quadriplegic and could not speak, and his caregiver had died, and therefore the court appointed a friend. And in that circumstance, he had a little over $100,000, and which wasn't very much, but the court-appointed trustee hired one lawyer to take care of one problem, then hired another lawyer to take care of another problem, and he ended up with three lawyers that actually was eating up almost all of his trust. And so I feel that there needs to be some kind of system in where we can prevent mismanagement of trust. And I want to thank Brad Swank, court administrator, for working so diligently on coming forward with this bill.
Thank you, Senator. I was looking through my file. There was an inquiry was made as to whether we have the Senate amendments to this bill in our files. I do.
Okay.
Okay. Did I give you a chance to explain the bill, counsel, or did I?
You did.
I jump you again. Okay. Let's hear from Mr. Swank, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. We worked with the good senator's office on the Senate side to help put together a program that we thought we could manage at a price we could afford, and I promised her I would be here today to answer any technical questions that you had.
Fine, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Are there questions from the committee to the panelists? See none. You've done your good job. Thank you very, very much. Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 881A? Please come forward. I have none signed up. Okay, you folks are excused. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 881A and open a work session on Senate Bill 881A. The chair will move that this bill be forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 881A is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. I will carry the bill, and the work session is closed. We'll resume the work session on House Bill 2157A, and I have the panelists come back. I apologize for the delay, but senators have rank. Ms. Meyer, who is next?
Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee. I'm trying to remember where we were. Interesting.
Well, I think Ms. Meyer gave an overview. Was it on the Dash 18 amendment?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director, ACLU. That's correct. We were just, I think, addressing some of the more substantive changes to the process that have been looked at since the last testimony was taken.
Okay. Let me just ask one question with that. You wanted the, on line 17, that to lower it from 65 to 60 years, is that correct?
Chair, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct. And in addition to that, there's some language, and I think Andrea is aware of this as well, that Native Americans don't limit an age for elderly, so there's an existing statute that DHS has. We would need to add elderly Native Americans to that, and I believe there's no objection to changing that either in the future.
Where would that be? Can you show me in the amendments?
Line 17, it's not there on the A18, and these would be some changes that we'll recommend to A18 on the Senate side.
Well, I'm trying to figure out which will be the quickest way for us to go, so I don't want to make a commitment that we're going to the Senate
okay.
side. Because sometimes we can do the amendments here and forward them to our full committee, and then it goes over, hopefully, without any retooling over there. But that's why I'm trying to go through the amendments to see whether we can help you now, whether we
sure.
you know, take us over to the Senate side. So the issue that had to be covered also was what? Say that to me again.
Line 17, when we're dealing with elderly
okay.
Native Americans,
okay.
Don't limit the age.
Okay.
So we would need to change 65 to 60 and then probably comma add elderly Native Americans.
Okay, we're just making those notes now. Okay, any other corrections for the dash 18? Okay, now tell me how you want to proceed on the rest of them. I need to know whether there's any other substantive changes other than just bringing agencies to opting in. Are there any other substantive changes?
Not that I'm aware of.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU, you have a lot of amendments before you. I think most of them are just adding folks. I do remain concerned about two things. One is because I just never heard who was representing the Legislative Administrative Committee as to why they were added on, I believe, Section 57. And I would still hope the committee would take some critical eye to all the folks being swept up into this. Number two, I do want to reiterate, because it was a concern I had and the committee did, Chair Ackerman, you also had it, which is the explicit exclusion of the Lottery Commission. To take a brief moment, in this bill are a lot of entities that have already been doing nationwide fingerprint checks, but it has some of the safeguards in it, the fitness determination that must be made by the agency and other safeguards, including return and destroying of the fingerprints. And the Lottery Commission has statutory authority to do this, and it's not our objection that they continue and have the authority. It's the safeguards and the question about why they would be explicitly written out of this large policy decision that's being made. Under their statute, which is 461, specifically 110, they can do FBI fingerprint checks, and actually the language that's been in a lot of other agencies, which is as long as the policy is that the FBI will not keep these and they're returned and destroyed, is not even there, let alone any of the other safeguards that they're required to do a fitness determination. I understand for some of their folks there might be a fitness determination by administrative rule, but I just remain really puzzled why they are exempted out. What happened was they came in towards the end of the process, and there was an amendment that was adopted through general government that excluded them. So we really didn't have the conversation.
Okay.
So those are my two concerns. Still having a critical eye to who's included and maybe pulling a few of these folks out, like Legislative Administrative Committee and the Lottery Commission.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'm going to have to go through the amendments to find out which are duplications, which apply, so I know how to forward this to the full committee. I think that's going to be the shortest route. So why don't we talk about the rest of the amendments that are with us this morning? We've done 18. How about 17? Is that to go in?
Yes, 17 goes in.
Representative Ackerman, I think I can give a brief summary of what amendments. I mean, simply that A through A11 would all need to be adopted.
Okay, let me A3 through 11.
A3 through A11.
Yes.
Okay.
And then 13. 14, 17, and 18. Those would be the amendments that where the work group was in agreement, there was no opposition, that we need to move forward on this.
Okay. Thank you, Council, and I appreciate. I should have remembered that that was on your summary, and I appreciate that work because it saves us a lot of time this morning. Are you folks in accord with Council's statement as to which amendments should come in?
But I can go through those again. That's the A3 through A11.
It's on the staff summary.
And then the 13s, 14s, 17s, and 18s.
Chair Ackerman, Andrea Meyer, I just have a question. I'm confused about the existence of the A17s. I thought the state, I'm just trying to look at it right now, I thought the state treasurer already had the ability on boards and commissions. They were sort of one of the, I'm looking at page 11, and I'm just trying to figure out what the change is, and it may be simple, but on the, is employed. So I don't know if council can explain or if he hasn't also had a chance to kind of figure out exactly.
No, the A-17s,
what are they changing?
Who? Just make a slight modification to who,
they're adding.
It basically expands who they can request the background checks for, the treasury, the state treasurer. It expands it to current employees and appointees, and their basic authority was for future employees and appointees.
Okay.
I imagine that's not an issue because where the work group ended up was to put the limiting factors in section 2 as we've been discussing in the 18 amendments, and that gives the agencies the authority where they can just say we're opting in to and then they opt in a broad manner, and that is limited by the statutory authority, the basic framework set out in section 2.
Chair, I can remember his opinion. I see. What they're doing here is they're just expanding it to is employed or applying for employment rather than what is currently in, which is persons who are being considered for employment. That seems to be the operative change. So with that, I'm not going to raise any objection.
Okay. Well, it's going to be well, let me ask the panel if you have any other items to present to us this morning before I open up for a few more questions.
Chair Ackerman, for the record, Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police. We were the sponsors of this bill, and we support the amendments that Mr. Sears presented with no further additions.
Chair Ackerman, for the record, Representative Kevin Cameron again. I just want to make a point about the opt-in, opt-out that was talked about earlier. The FBI requires specific authority, legislative authority, from each agency. That's why we have the opting in on this particular bill. I just wanted to put that on the record. Currently, we have 28 agencies within the state that are authorized to do fingerprinting, and with no system that is bringing them together, and this is a good thing that would help get us to there. On the Oregon Lottery, they are one of those 28 agencies who've been doing it for 20 years for different reasons than come under this particular bill, and in the future I still want to recommend and go on record that we need to continue to look at the overall process that's going on in the state with those existing 28 agencies, including the Oregon Lottery and the ones that we're bringing in today.
Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
In just a moment.
Okay.
I have one more point to make, and I want to make sure we've exhausted all the issues on the amendments which we have to rolled in this morning. I hear no further discussion on those. I raised an issue last time about immunity, and maybe I could direct this to Ms. Meyer. The way I read this on page 3, subsection 13, it states out that the authorized agency and an employee of that agency is immune from civil liability. Then as you continue down, it says the authorized agency or employee who in good faith complies with this decision is not liable. I take that to mean not a claim of blanket immunity, but that the immunity can be pierced if the agency or its employee acts in bad faith. Would you concur with that, and do you think that's an adequate standard?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, what I can tell you, and I urge that there be some others who take a look at this, particularly I think the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, who has the expertise on looking at this language. My recollection, I think we all agreed, was the term good faith, actually, according to Virginia Vanderbilt, if I can put words in her mouth, we were all confused as to whether that was even necessary and what that meant. So I'm not sure that buzzword provides any additional safeguards. One of the concerns that we would have and I think it's addressed, is if disclosure is made by an employee that is an impermissible disclosure, either by negligence or intentionally, that there be some cause of action or protection to the individual rather than disclosure that is permitted to be given to another person because it is allowed. For instance, if an agency, I'll just give you the example of the Department of Education does it for the school bus drivers. I may have this mostly correct, but it will work as an example. They're not to give it to the districts necessarily, the information. DHS makes the determination. If they then turned over the actual criminal history report, that would be impermissible under the law, as I understand it. If they say to that Department of Education, you can employ that person, their record is permitted, they fall under the fitness criteria and they're employable, or they're not employable, that information is appropriate to give. But if they impermissibly passed on the criminal history record or some personal information about the person where it's not allowed by statute, I don't know if you have any more information on the immunity. So, Chair Ackerman, I'm a little concerned that I not be your total safeguard on the determination of the adequacy of that language. From my understanding, I think we're comfortable with it, but I would certainly want other eyes to be making sure that that understanding is clear as to what your intentions are.
Right. This is a provision that gives me the most problems because even though there may be some form of immunity given here, the enormity of a mistake here to cost someone his license or his career seems to me not to justify the type of immunity which is granted in this subsection. President McPherson, do you have any comments on the immunity? You and I have talked about it and raised it on the floor a number of times, not always successfully, but
I haven't studied the immunity provision
right
in this. Which section are we looking at?
We're on page 3, line 28.
Mm-hmm.
While you're looking at that, I'll see if there's any more.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Friesen, it is limited to the determination of whether someone's fit. Maybe you all realize that, but at least that sentence and the immunity is already restricted to the employment decision or the licensing decision. Based on the information. Now, the person still does have the ability to challenge and go through a process about the accuracy of the information. But
that raises another problem, because the accuracy of the information is submitted by the FBI and the state police cannot be challenged in the APA proceeding. Is that correct?
Chair Ackerman, maybe I'll let Patricia chime in after me if I can. But my understanding is if you get your criminal history record back from the FBI, they're the ones who've created it. If it's wrong, you can't go to the Oregon State Police or to the agency that's required to say, could you fix my criminal history record from the FBI, because they don't have the authority. The fix to that record can only be made at the FBI. Likewise, if Oregon State Police creates a criminal history record on me from their information and it's a mistake, whether I've got a dispute and they agree to it, I can only go to them to fix that. When the agency is making the assessment of employment or licensing, they will look at hopefully a lot of other factors, and that they can fix that general record of their determination, but not the particular criminal history record that's received from the police, law enforcement agencies.
I agree with that.
That's correct, Chair Ackerman.
Okay.
Yes, if there is a dispute as far as the criminal history content, it is to be taken care of through the agencies that were submitting the information and not through the contested case process.
Do we know if the agencies have a procedure to correct their records? I'm talking about FBI, state police. I don't know how this works.
Yes, Chair Ackerman, there's statute and administrative rule that we will review the records, verify the correction, and make the correction on site.
Okay, I appreciate knowing that. Okay, further questions?
There's also,
yes,
Chair Ackerman, Hella Rody from Department of Justice. There's also the contested case process set forth in the bill, that allows the person who has a background check done on them to contest the decision of the agency. And so there is a check and balance there in that regard. The immunity, as I understand it, is limited to situations where the agency or the employee act lawfully and in good faith.
I understand all those other issues would be open during the contested case hearing. other than challenging the basic documents upon which the criminal history is based. And you're telling me that those agencies have processes to do that, which probably, I guess, a licensee who was subjected to this would try to get straightened out before.
Chair Ackerman, I think those agencies will have to start having them, which is, of course, why we've had concerns about the broad scope of this, because there are some agencies that do. DHS has really got a very refined system, has been doing this for a long time, but we're expanding this, and we're trusting that they'll do everything. And that is why, particularly crafting who should even have fingerprints done, needs to be in statute, because we can't just leave it to all these agencies, departments, licensing boards to, they aren't required to have a uniform, but they are going to be required to comply with this somehow, you know, in rules.
Okay. Representative McPherson, do you have any closing comments or issues on this? We're in work session, and we will probably gavel in a number of amendments.
This bill is a work in progress, Mr. Chair, and I would say it's and I appreciate all the energy people have brought to it. It's going to be a bit Rube Goldberg-esque in its kind of in the final product, I think, in any event. And I'll just watch it unfold here and weigh in if I have any particular thoughts.
Okay, I appreciate your help. I think it's the intent of the chair to gavel in the relevant amendments and forward it to the committee with a due pass, and then let the more extended discussion maybe take place there on some of the issues we've raised this afternoon, because this is a large bill with larger implications, but I think I'd feel better if it went to the full committee.
Chair Ackerman, Andrea Meyer, so we're clear, because as we leave the stand, I believe Representative Cameron agrees that the A18s will now replace the A15s. And I don't know if you have a cheat sheet, but it's probably not on there yet. But that is that correct, Representative Cameron, that we are?
That's correct, with the understanding that we worked through some of those details earlier mentioned, and I think that is on the cheat sheet.
Okay. Mind me.
Now, what was that? Was there a substitution? I wouldn't.
A18s will replace the A15s.
The amendments I previously mentioned were included that change.
Yes, they did. Okay. And I think as we, particularly with respect to 18, it would be, Council, should we just leave that out and make those corrections and bring it back to the full committee? There's one about changing the age.
Why don't we just adopt it now, and then we'll have one more amendment to adopt in full committee.
Okay, that's fine. So I think we're all on board. I think it's, to see my strategy here, I'd rather do this here than have you convince a Senate committee 2 weeks from now to do what we're doing. Okay.
Chair Ackerman, we appreciate that, as I'd be very nervous.
I will catch you.
Otherwise.
Okay, I'm. We are in work session, and Representative Girard has raised his hand and waved his pencil at me.
I'm just ready to make a motion on this bill, finally.
So. Okay.
I would move the -3s, -4s, -5s, -6, -7, -8, -9, -10, -11, -13, -14, -17, and -18. To House Bill 2157A, with a side comment that we would hope that the work group would review 18 somewhere along the line.
All right, you've heard the motion, which I will not repeat because I think it was so clearly done.
No, thank you.
and in the interest of time, I'll ask if there's any discussions on the motion on these on these amendments. Hearing none, the motion then is allowed, and those amendments are put into House Bill 2157.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2157A as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves House Bill 2157 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, the clerk may close. Call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worth absent. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 2157A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you for your participation in this very, very difficult task.
Yeah, we'll take it up.
I'll just mark you.
I've been by Terry this morning. I thought Cameron
the probably carried the committee.
Yes, sir. Representative Garrard will carry the bill to the committee, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2157. Okay, let me back up to
3, 11, 13, 14, 17, 18.
I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 215. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 215 comes to you from the Department of Justice. Requires an attorney who has filed an antitrust class action on behalf of a natural person to give the Attorney General within 30 days of the complaint written notice of the action and a copy of the complaint. Requires the attorney of the person in a class action suit brought under the Oregon antitrust provision to notify the Attorney General in writing of a proposed settlement and to provide a copy of the proposed settlement.
Okay, those persons wishing to testify on Senate Bill 215, please come forward. I only have two on the sign-up sheet. I have two at the panel, and I hope it's the same two people. I'd like to state your names for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 215.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Microsoft, also in support of Senate Bill 215.
Thank you. Do you gentlemen have testimony on the bill, or should we just see if there's questions from the committee?
Chair Ackerman, I do have some testimony.
Yes, please. Proceed.
This bill will help the Attorney General's office monitor antitrust actions affecting Oregonians' interest in the attorney in which the Attorney General is not involved. The bill will give the Attorney General the opportunity to review and, if necessary, comment upon the terms of the settlement and the proposed fee award that class counsel seeks. The majority of antitrust class action settlements involving consumers are fair. However, some class actions settle on terms that may be unfair to class members. There are instances in which the terms of the settlement have been brought into question as not adequately serving the consumer's interest or providing too much money to the attorneys in the form of attorney's fees. Attorney General Myers formed an interim study committee comprised of representatives from the academic community, business, and consumer interest groups, both the plaintiff and the defense bar, and the Oregon Department of Justice. This committee, the committee members unanimously agreed that this bill would be helpful in curbing problem settlements and giving the Attorney General a better opportunity to provide a comments in cases where the value of the settlement for Oregonians was inadequate and or the attorney's fees were excessive. There are currently 12 states that have this type of notification to the Attorney General. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 215.
Thank you. I will hear from the next witness and open it up for questions. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bill Taylor will remember this as an outcome of a discussion that we had during the closing hours of the 2001 legislative session in a set of bills that involved the so-called Illinois brick doctrine. The prior witness mentioned a part of the resolution of that very difficult issue was appointment of a interim work group, which I had the privilege of co-chairing together with Andy Albertine, who at the time was the head of the antitrust section in the Oregon Department of Justice. Our work group included very distinguished members of the antitrust trial bar from both sides. Representative McPherson will recognize one name, Barnes Ellis, senior litigation partner at Stoll Reeves, and equally eminent folks from the other side of the litigation aisle. This bill addresses a real problem, which is that often in antitrust settlements, the attorneys, the plaintiff attorneys will get the money, and the class members will get coupons. It is an issue which, in appropriate cases, that may be an appropriate remedy, but where a class of natural persons is represented, and where the case may be brought, for instance, as a pendant claim to a federal action out of state, there really is a role for the Attorney General in his what's called parens patriae capacity to look out for the interests of Oregonians. So we think this is an important bill. It was brought before the legislature last session, got lost in the shuffle at the end, and we would urge you not only to look favorably on it, but to seek an opportunity for a work session and move it forward.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Boss, can you tell me what it's meant by a natural person?
Chair Ackman, counsel, a natural person is a flesh and blood human being as opposed to a fictitious created entity like a corporation or a partnership.
So this bill would be limited just to natural persons?
That is correct.
Thanks.
Sure.
Further questions for the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Yeah, just following up on that question. So does the class have to be limited only to natural persons, or if it were a class that includes natural persons, is that sufficient for this to be invoked?
Chair Ackman, Representative McPherson, it is my understanding that if it includes natural persons.
Okay. And then a follow-up, if I might.
Sure.
This relates to class actions that are brought under a particular ORS statute, and there was a reference, I think, in the presentation a moment ago to pendant actions to federal theories. So, and I know these class action cases go forward in a very complex way. So I take it that there are typically both federal and state theories, and so I'm assuming that if there's any state theory that's brought under the Oregon statute, then that's sufficient to invoke this provision. So we're in effect saying, if I could recite what I understand to be the case, is that if you're going to use the Oregon statute as the basis for a remedy or any part of the remedy you seek, then you have to give notice of the settlement to the AG's office.
Chair Ackman, Representative McPherson, that is correct.
Okay. Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, just to follow up on Representative McPherson's question concerning whether it would have to be a class of all natural persons or include natural persons. Mr. Boss, the language says action on behalf of a class of natural persons. So could you elaborate on why it would be including natural persons? Could you give us maybe an example?
It's my, Chair Ackman, counsel. The goal of this statute is to, or of this bill is to protect consumers, mm-hmm. And so what the work group wanted was, and what this bill proposes, to protect people who are consumers and consumers who are natural persons. Business entities are not defined as consumers. It is my reading of that there would, if there were included consumers in the class action, then this bill would come into operation. I believe that is the intent of the statute or of the bill is to protect consumers.
So within, if I may follow up, within the class action, it would be the class of natural persons.
Representative Ackerman, counsel, correct.
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Could I also respond to that? Typically, in a so-called mixed class, where you have business entities as well as individuals, you will designate what are called subclasses. And so the intent would be to afford this new protection to the subclass that consists of the natural persons within the overall class. That's technically the way it would work.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. We're only here on a public hearing, so this is not yet work session. Do you know if this will be scheduled for work session? Do we have any information at this time? We're only here on a public hearing.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll do what we possibly can to bring it on to work session. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 215. And, committee, I think we have two items left, reconsideration issue and one item. Yeah, we have a work session on Senate Bill 239, and I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 239 at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 239 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and the bill creates consistency throughout Oregon's anti-discrimination laws concerning who is protected. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon's anti-discrimination laws are intended to protect individuals from discrimination because of an individual's inherent status. Which, when you look through these laws, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you will notice, the different various laws, there's no consistency as to who the protected class is. It varies from statute to statute. I think, and I've recent my limited experience in this area, I think it was done on an ad hoc basis. There may have been a policy reason at the time for including one group and not the other, but I think it was more likely that it was added ad hoc over a 20-year period. The Oregon Law Commission 2 years ago enacted a law that sponsored a bill that reorganized Oregon's unlawful employment and unlawful discrimination laws. At that time, they did not address the issue. They waited to do it later. And it's their intent, and in the bill to do so, to create a consistent class as much as possible throughout these anti-discrimination statutes. Wendy Johnson is here on behalf of the commission if you have any further questions. There are no amendments proposed to the bill.
I understand then, counsel, there are no substantive changes here.
No, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee.
Okay.
At least, let me say it this way. It's possible that there could be substantive changes in the sense that a different group is added to a particular statute that was not there before. So that could have substantive changes, but it's very difficult to discern what the policy reason for not including that individual class in that particular statute.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Then, hearing none, I will move that Senate Bill 239 be forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye. Excuse me, aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth absent. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 239 is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill and conclude the work session on Senate Bill 239. Committee, we have just one more matter to deal with, and I think it's the first item on today's agenda, possible reconsideration work session of Senate Bill 920A. Council, you want to explain the procedural issues here?
Yes, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 920A is also from the Oregon Law Commission. It's the bill that revises Oregon's laws relating to execution sales, passed out of a civil subcommittee and the full committee. It's back before us so that we can adopt conflict amendments. This bill conflicts with House Bill 2359, which is the bill relating to... It escapes me at the moment, but the point is a conflict amendment. It's not making a substantive change. It's just making sure that these bills, when they're finally adopted as a statute, do not, that they mesh together, they read together. So that's the purpose of this reconsideration.
Council, then I have to open a work session in order to do the reconsideration and rule suspension?
Yes.
Okay, then I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 920A.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gerard?
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 920A.
Representative Gerard has moved that the rules be suspended for the purposes of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 920A. This motion is undebatable. Those that are of the opinion the rule should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SB 920 will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed, no. Was there three ayes there?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I didn't hear the third one, but I want to make sure I don't... Okay, I have it as 3-0. The motion carries, and the rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I would move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 920A was sent to the floor with the due pass as amended recommendation.
President Garrard moves that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 920A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Those that are of the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 920A was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, no. The motion carries. The vote has been reconsidered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Garrard.
I move the A5 amendments to resolve conflicts to Senate Bill 920A.
Representative Garrard moves that the A5 amendments to resolve conflicts to Senate Bill 920A. Is there discussion from the committee? Hearing none, then those with the opinion that the A5 amendments to resolve conflicts to SB 920 be adopted will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. I have it as 3-0. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Garrard.
I move Senate Bill 920A to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves Senate Bill 920A to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Those are of the opinion that we pass, that we move Senate Bill 920A to the full committee with a due pass as amended recommendation will say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries 3-0. I will carry the bill. Is there further matters to come before the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Script.